So during the summer, we've taken a short break from our study of the first five books of the Bible and are tackling questions that you've sent to us. And so as we do each Sunday, we'll have a short live Q&A time in which you can text your questions in that are connected to the sermon this morning. And so you can kind of send those in. That number is always going to be up on the screen. But the question that we're going to be dealing with this morning, the question that was sent in this morning was, what do the laws and instructions in the Old Testament tell us about the character of God? Especially when they seem to contradictory to a loving God. In other words, is there a contradiction between the God in the Old Testament and Jesus in the New Testament? Or another way to put that question is God in the Old Testament harsh, whereas Jesus in the New Testament is loving and kind? Is there a contradiction there? Is there something missing? And for those of you who had the opportunity to read through the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, you come to different passages in Scripture where anybody with, where any of us begin to feel a bit uncomfortable. And what I want to do this morning is to come to one of those passages, and it's this passage in Deuteronomy where God commands the people of Israel to destroy the inhabitants of Canaan. And as we read this passage, our first response must be a feeling of discomfort, pain, and sorrow for what this narrative is describing to be happening. And my goal for us as we look at this passage, which is one of the harder passages in the Old Testament, that we would identify three things, that we would identify what this passage is not teaching us. And then secondly, that we would identify what this passage teaches us about God's character. Because every passage, every command, every instruction teaches us, points us to who God is. So we would identify what this passage teaches us about God's character. And then finally, that we'd be able to answer the question, is there a contradiction between the God in the Old Testament and Jesus, who is God, the Son of God, who shows up in the New Testament? And there's this place where when we come to a passage like Deuteronomy chapter 20, which you can kind of begin to turn, there will be verse 16 through 18. When we come to a passage like Deuteronomy chapter 20, oftentimes our natural response is to ignore it. Because that's the easiest way, right? As we kind of ignore it, we say this is kind of an antiquated, you know, thing. It happened at, you know, a moment in time. We're going to ignore it. Hopefully, my friends who ask about Jesus don't ask me about this passage. And we're just going to ignore it, put it to the side, pretend like it's not there. Let's just jump to, you know, the other passages that are kind of more comfortable for us. And we even sometimes go so far as almost drive this wedge between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And kind of say, well, the Old Testament, that was kind of like, you know, when God was angry. And in the New Testament, that's kind of the part of the Bible that I like to study and where I like to kind of rest in. And what we begin to inadvertently or maybe on purpose do is that we begin to do this Build-A-Bear version of God, right? Where we begin to create God as defined by what's comfortable for me, what fits for me, and even what is safe for me. And as C.S. Lewis wrote in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is a kid's fantasy fiction, which is an excellent book for all of us to read, The Chronicles of Narnia, he writes about how Susan, one of the kids who gets kind of sucked into through this wardrobe, her and her siblings get sucked into the land of Narnia, this magical place where the animals talk. Yes, they talk. And I don't know how C.S. Lewis came up with these ideas, but the animals talk. And the animal, Mr. Beaver, is speaking to Susan, and he's telling Susan about Aslan. And Aslan is the Christ character in these fiction novels. And he's explaining Aslan to her, and he says that he writes this, or C.S. Lewis writes this, he says this, Aslan is a lion, the great lion. Oh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good and he's the king, I tell you. And that's what I want us to come away with this morning. It is not that we come away with a God who fits well within our system or within what feels right for us or who is safe, but we come away seeing God as he is. So let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16 through 18. I want to kind of read it with us together so you can kind of follow along in your Bibles. If you're using one of our church Bibles, it is on page 163. So Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 16 through 18. This is the instructions that God gives the people of Israel. It says this, "But in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance," in other words, in the promised land, in the land of Canaan, "you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices and that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God." So in this passage, which is given by Moses in the book of Deuteronomy is made up of a number of sermons that Moses is preaching to the people as they're getting ready to enter into the promised land, the land that God had promised to give the people of Israel, beginning with Genesis 15, where he promised this to Abraham. Moses is preaching, he's giving them the instructions that God has given them and saying that when you enter into the promised land, you are to destroy everything in this land. Now, what is this passage not teaching us? The first thing that we see that this passage is not teaching us is that Israel could destroy anyone they wanted. And the reason we understand that God is not giving Israel free reign to just kind of destroy anybody, anyone they wanted and any place that they wanted is because if we back up a few verses and we see the full instruction here, which begins in verse 10, what we see is that God gives them a different instruction, the people of Israel, a different instruction for dealing with the inhabitants of cities and lands outside of the promised land that they might wage war against. And we're told that in those lands, they were allowed to wage war if they chose to do so, but they were not to destroy everything. And so God is not only giving them a boundary, but he's being very specific that God is the one who decides who is destroyed and who's not. It was not Israel's decision to do so. And then secondly, what this passage does not teach us is it does not teach us that Israel was some kind of a superior nation or superior people group to the other groups, the other nations in that land. If you turn back a few pages to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 6 through 8, we see God giving the people of Israel the reason by which he's chosen them as his people. He says this, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God." And that word holy literally means separated. "The Lord your God has chosen you to be people for his treasured possession out of all the people who are of the face of the earth." So far, so good. Feeling pretty good about myself. I'm an Israelite. You chose me. I'm special. It's verse 7. "It was not because of you. It was not because of you were of more number than other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you. For you were the fewest of all the people." In other words, it had nothing to do with you or your potential that you had. I just simply chose you for my glory, for my will, for my purpose. Verse 8, "But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, and the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand, redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt." And we see this throughout the narratives in the Old Testament where God continually comes back to his people and says, "The reason that I've chosen you, the reason that I continue to be faithful to you is not because of your faithfulness to me, is not because somehow you are deserving of my grace and my mercy and my slowness towards anger that I show you. It is simply because I've chosen you. And I've chosen you for my glory, for my will. In fact, I've chosen you as a small nation, the smallest of the nations, so that as people might see you, they would see me and I would be the hero rather than you being the hero." And we continue to see the fact that Israel was not superior to other nations in Leviticus chapter 18, verses 24 through 28. So if you flip back a few more pages, and page 97, we see that In the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, verse 24, it says this: do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things. In other words, he's talking about the way in which the Israelites were to live their life and sinning. He's saying, do not sin in any of these ways. And he's listed a bunch of different ways previously. For by all these, the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean. And the land has become unclean, so that I punish its iniquity, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who are before you did all the abominations, so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nations that was before you. So we begin to get a little bit of a picture of why God is choosing to use the Israelites to destroy the inhabitants of the land. What we're seeing is that the reason God is choosing the Israelites to destroy the inhabitants of the land is because of their wickedness. But I want you to notice verse 28. Verse 28 tells us that that the wickedness that is leading God to use the people of Israel to destroy the inhabitants of the land is the same measurement by which God is going to judge his own people. Right? Because he says, look, as I use you as my tool to exact my judgment upon the land, know that this is also a warning to you that if you do not live differently from them, if you also choose to make the land unclean by living in sin, by worshiping false gods, if you choose to do that, the land will also vomit you out. And if you follow throughout the Old Testament, you find that that actually happens with the Babylonian captivity, in which God takes a pagan nation and does to Israel what God used Israel to do to the people, the Amorites, and the land of Canaan. So this passage is not teaching that somehow Israel is allowed to do what they want, nor that Israel was somehow more superior than other nations. So what is the passage teaching us about God's character? Well, the first thing that the passage teaches us about God's character is that God is merciful. Now you might go, well, wait a second. Where is the mercy in this? Turn back to Genesis chapter 15. For a moment with me. In Genesis chapter 15, God comes to Abraham. And as he comes to Abraham, he makes this covenant with Abraham, this promise with Abraham, in which he says, Abraham, I am going to make you into a father of many nations. You are going to be my I'm going to make you a father of many nations, and through your descendants, I am going to bless the earth, speaking of the fact that Jesus would show up through Abraham's line. And as he does that and makes the promise to Abraham that he will give him specifically these lands, the lands of Canaan, what we find is that God then says, although I'm giving you these lands, I'm not going to give them to you right away. Verse 13 of chapter 15 of Genesis says this: but then the Lord said to Abraham, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Speaking of the time that the people of Israel would spend in Egypt. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to the fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they, the people of Israel, shall come back here in the fourth generation, roughly 500-ish years later. Why? For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So what we see here is that God is telling Abraham and that even though I'm going to give you this land, the people living in this land, I'm going to show them grace and mercy for another 500 years and not destroy them, because their wickedness is not at a place where it demands destruction in the way that I would choose to destroy them when your people are rescued out of the land of Egypt. So, in other words, God is restraining his wrath towards the inhabitants of Canaan for over 500 years. And at the same time, it's important for us to understand when we come to the question of God's judgment, when we see God's judgment showing up in the Bible. One of the temptations for us is to look at those narratives, look at those passages, and go, man, I'm thankful that that's not me. You know, I'm thankful that I'm not like them. Or if I was there, you know, I would not have done that. When in reality, the Bible points to the fact that our brokenness and our sinfulness is in many ways no different than the people who lived in the land of Canaan. And we see this as we go to Romans chapter 5, verse 12. In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, Paul reminds us of the fact that therefore just as sin came into the world through one man, who was that man that sin came in through? Adam. And death through sin, so death spread to all men because all have sinned. And so what happened is that the moment in which Adam and Eve chose to sin against God by disobeying his commands, that sin entered into all of humanity. And the curse of sin entered into all of humanity so that at that moment, the trees began to wilt and death began to show up within God's perfect created order. And as death and sin and destruction entered into the world, we see that that then flows from Adam and Eve to who? To their kids, Cain and Abel, right? And the first murder takes place. And then that flows into their kids and their kids and their kids and their kids. And so what happens is, and what the Bible shows us is the fact that our brokenness before God, our sinfulness, does not begin at the moment in which we sin for the first time as a child. Our brokenness and our sinfulness begins at the moment of our existence. On a side note, we've got a couple of preteens, right? And so next time you get in trouble with your parents, you can just say, well, you know, it's really not my fault. It's actually dad's fault. Like, it's because of dad that I did this. I mean, let's just be honest. Dad was sinful, and that just, I can't help it. Selah and Kai, give that a shot and see what happens. Not going to work on me. But that's the reality, right? And at the same time, we then come to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1 through 4, which also describes the state that we are in apart from Christ. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1 says, and you are dead in your trespasses and sins in which you once walked. In other words, you have no life in you. You have no capacity because of the curse of sin. You have no capacity to breathe life into yourself or to make decisions that are honoring to God and that are not rooted in sin. You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of the flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind. As we come back to Deuteronomy chapter 20, it's important for us that we understand that we are much more like the Canaanites than we want to admit. That we are much more deserving of God's just wrath than we would like to admit. So what does this passage teach us about God's character? That God is merciful. And on a side note, does anybody remember Rahab? Rahab was a Canaanite woman, right? And not only was she a Canaanite woman, she was a prostitute. And so when you look at the social status, she's at the bottom of the social status in her community. And what do we find? We find that Rahab ends up helping the spies in the city of Jericho. And what does God do? God miraculously not only rescues her and saves her as the city is destroyed, but Rahab shows up as whose great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother? Does anybody know? Jesus. So we find in this beautiful picture of mercy and grace that God not only rescues and saves people from within the Canaanites, but he brings this Canaanite woman who, from a social class order, is at the bottom of the social rung and makes her into being part of the most important be a part of that line and lineage, the most important lineage in the world, which is the lineage by whom Jesus showed up. So what else does this passage teach us about God's character? Well, the second thing, and really the thing that is in some senses most obvious, is that it teaches us that God is righteous and holy. And that his righteousness and holiness gives him the capacity and the, not only capacity, but his righteousness and holiness demands that he responds to unrighteousness and holiness with judgment. And we see it in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 4 through 5. In which it says, "Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them," speaking to the people of Israel, "do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you." And so we see that it was God using the people of Israel as a tool to exact judgment upon the wickedness of the people. Now, how do we reconcile God the Father, who exacted his wrath upon the wickedness of the inhabitants of Canaan, with Jesus Christ? That's the question, right? How do we reconcile these two things? You know, is there some kind of a contradiction from God here, who exacts his judgment upon the nations in Canaan, from Jesus who shows up thousands of years later? Simply put, I would argue there is no contradiction. And here's why. God does not change in his character from the Old Testament to the New Testament. What changes from the Old Testament to the New Testament is the direction upon which God the Father is pointing his arrow of wrath and judgment. Because when Jesus shows up, where does God point the arrow of wrath and judgment, his bow of wrath and judgment? Where does he point it to? He points it to his son, Jesus Christ. So God's character of exacting judgment upon wickedness does not in any way go away. But the place in which he points it changes. And even that isn't true, because he doesn't change, because we see from Genesis chapter 3, verse 14, that when God is giving the curse to the serpent, he also blesses the woman and says that, you know, that by your seed, who is Jesus, that Jesus will come and he'll crush the serpent's head. And so we understand, even from the beginning of time, that God's plan of pointing his bow of wrath and judgment, his war bow of wrath and judgment towards wickedness, all along was planned to be pointed at the heart of his son, Jesus Christ. But in the New Testament, when Jesus shows up, that is made true. It is consummated. And so to understand what feels like a dichotomy between the Old Testament and the New Testament, we must come to the cross, where we see in the most clearest sense God's judgment towards wickedness and God's grace and mercy towards the wicked. That's where we see that, at that intersection. Because it's at that intersection that we most clearly see God's character, the fact that God the Father is a perfect judge and Jesus Christ is a faultless mediator. It's at the cross that we see the absolute justice towards our wickedness and the unimaginable mercy, as Jesus Christ takes that wrath that God is showing towards our wickedness upon himself. And it's at the cross that we most clearly see God's character, his righteous wrath towards our sin, and Jesus Christ, the sacrificial lamb. If the Bible ended in Deuteronomy chapter 20, we could make a very fair, in some sense, fair argument that God is simply this maniacal God who is here to just kind of destroy people at his whim and according to, you know, what he desires. And that is true. God is able to do that, and yet at the same time, his character of love and goodness and being slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love means that he would point his wrath not at us, but at his son, Jesus Christ. So I want to encourage us to know that a deeper understanding of God's holiness and justice and righteousness and judgment upon wickedness should not produce in us a desire to kind of push God away, but it should produce in us, as we see the cross, produce in us a greater realization for God's love, grace, mercy that he's shown at the cross. Now, does that make what happened in Deuteronomy chapter 20 easier? Absolutely not. Does that make us kind of go to Deuteronomy chapter 20 and just go, well, it's not a big deal? There's a tension there in Deuteronomy 20 that we cannot fully resolve. But what we can do is that we can come to the cross where we see most clearly God's righteous justice and judgment upon wickedness and the depth of the grace and mercy shown us in Christ. And my prayer for us as a church is that we grasp that love and grace shown to us in Christ. My prayer for us is that we recognize that God is worthy not only of worship on Sunday morning, but that he is worthy of all that we are and all that we have. And so that leads us to a place where we invest in our neighbors and invite them into our life. Why? Because we love others as what Christ has loved us. And we understand that our hope and our security does not rest in our comfort, but instead it rests in what Christ has done for us. And as we invest in our neighbors, invite them into our lives, loving others as Christ has loved us, may we point those within our circle of influence to Jesus, who is our big brother, our high priest, and our king, who bore God the Father's just wrath upon his shoulders that should have been on us. May we point them to Christ, in whom our hope is anchored. So take a moment now to kind of go through a couple questions that you might have. So if you've got a question, you can text those in. The first question is, why isn't God safe? And I think that's a good question. Why isn't God safe? So I don't have a good Bible verse where I can tell you, like, well, this is the Bible verse that I would point to. But when we speak about safe, I think safe means not dangerous, right? For something to be safe, it means that it's... you know, it's not dangerous. It's, why am I trying to create more words? It's not dangerous. The moments throughout the Bible where we see man interacting with God directly, where God is in some sense unfettered, his glory is unfettered. In each of those moments, the response that we see from man is not a response of, hey, what's up, dude? Let's hang out. The response is always a response of absolute terror and fear. But it's not a terror and fear that leads. You know, when you're afraid of something, what do you usually do? You run in the opposite direction, right? If you're not, unless you're crazy. You run in the opposite direction. But the fear and terror that we see, guys like Isaiah, who in Isaiah chapter 6, who he sees God, we find, what is his response? His response, he falls on the ground in terror and he goes, God, I am unclean. Moses, who sees the back of God, we see Moses' response is that he turns because he can't. Even the back of God is too much for him to handle. The fearful response that people had in those moments where we see men and women seeing God is a fear that leads them to not to run away, as fear often does, but it leads them to go, I am not worthy. And so the concept of God not being safe is not, he's not safe because it's like a snake that might bite you and kill you. The reason he's not safe is because we are not worthy on our own to be in his presence or to be with him. And so I think that's what the communication that, you know, that C.S. Lewis is trying to make there is the idea that God is not this domesticated kind of what we've done often in our culture, which is we've created God to fit well within our framework. We've domesticated him so that the parts of God that kind of don't work well with our culture, we kind of either hide or we kind of take away, kind of do that Build-A-Bear thing. And what Lewis is getting at with the scripture, what we see throughout scriptures is that God is not safe because we are unworthy of him. And yet God is a good king in which we are most safe in his presence because of his mercy and his grace. And so there's this beautiful, once again, what's the word that I'm looking for? Tension in that reality. And so for parents, I would encourage you to help your kids, teach them that God is not safe. And at the same time, he is loving. And at the same time, he is the ultimate demonstration of sacrificial love. You know, teach them all of these things about who God is. The next question that we have here is, as Abraham was saved by faith, does God's arrow of wrath really change directions at the cross, or does the judgment of the Canaanites happen due to specific sins? So that's a great question, and that's a really good point. So you're right, and I even kind of said it in the sermon, that God's direction in one sense doesn't change because it was always pointed to the cross from the beginning of time, because Abraham's salvation was through faith, and we see that those who followed after him, their salvation was through faith in the promise of Jesus. And at the same time, the arrow of God's judgment upon the Canaanites was specific to their sins, in that there was a culmination in which their sins got to a place where the land vomited them out. I think what's important for us to remember and understand is that although their sin was unique, God has every right to pour his wrath out on every group of people throughout all times. And so we don't want to create this hierarchy, well, at least I'm not like the Canaanites where, you know, they really deserve God's wrath, but I don't. I think the key for us to understand is that we all, because of our brokenness and our sin, deserve God's wrath. And yet at the same time, Genesis chapter 20 is a snippet, a small window into what is to come, which is the day of the Lord. Now, if you read the book of Revelations, what you find is that we find that Jesus shows up again. What does Jesus look like when he shows up again? Revelation chapter 20, I think it is. Jesus shows up on a warrior horse with writing on his legs saying, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, carrying a sword and exacting absolute destruction upon everybody. And this picture of Jesus that we see riding on the white horse is not a picture of it's not a picture of peace. And so I think there's also a place where Genesis 20 is a small picture into what the day of the Lord looks like, all the while understanding that ultimately God has exacted judgment upon wickedness and sin upon his son, Jesus Christ. And that's what allows us today to stand before God accepted and loved.